An article in the following program contains explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, and welcome to Rolling Stone Magazine. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Brian Kim, reading today from recent articles posted to rollingstone.com. Our first article today is an album review by Rob Sheffield. This was posted on April 19th, 2024, and it's called Come for the Torture, Stay for the Poetry. This might be Taylor Swift's most personal album yet. Poets only want love if it's torture, and when the poet is Taylor Swift, you always have to figure love and torture are never more than a few verses apart. Taylor became a legend as the poet laureate of teen romance, but that was kid stuff compared to the adult heartbreak of her stunning new album, The Tortured Poets Department. A year after getting out of a six-year relationship, Taylor's got bad men on the brain, but they've always been her specialty. As she notes here, in a poem she includes in the physical edition, it's the worst men that I write best. Taylor might be the self-proclaimed chairman of the Tortured Poets Department, but judging by these songs, business is booming. It's the cathartic confession of a woman who thought she had adulthood and adult romance all figured out, only to find herself realizing she knows nothing. From My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys, to Fortnite, to Clara Bow, these 30-something breakup tales are new turf for her. She sounds confused, bitter, raging, vulnerable, yet more gloriously chaotic than we've ever heard her before. Even by Swiftian standards, she gets wildly ambitious with her songwriting here. This is an album that begins with an introductory poem by Stevie Nicks. The title song's chorus goes, "You're not Dylan Thomas, I'm not Patti Smith, this ain't the Chelsea Hotel, we're modern idiots." In other words, it's a small-town teen romance of white horse updated for the big old city. Until you remember that the tortured poet Dylan Thomas famously died at his favorite Greenwich Village bar, which happened to be the White Horse Tavern. That's the level she's working on here. Tortured Poets has the intimate sound of Folklore and Evermore, but with a coating of Midnight's synth-pop gloss. The songs go for that detailed Folkmore style of storycraft, yet instead of fictional characters, she's pouring her heart into her own deeply personal exorcisms. Sometimes her adult breakup tales are devastating, as in So Long London or LOML. Sometimes they're hilarious, as in My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys or Down Bad. But they're usually both, as she quips in Who's Afraid of Little Old Me, "Tell me everything's not about me, but what if it is?" You can hear that it's an album made in the aftershock of the Eras Tour, which was bigger than even Taylor could have wildest dreamed. One revelation from the Eras Tour was how epic the Folklore, and especially Evermore, songs sounded when ringing out loud in a stadium. It sounds as though Swift was shocked at how it felt to play her quietest songs live and hear how gigantic they could be given enough room. So Tortured Poets feels like Swift writing those Folkmore and especially Evermore ballads, but giving them that stadium power in the studio. As for torture, she's got loads of that. From the sound of Midnight's, everybody figured her relationship with Joe Alwyn was a happy little sweet nothing, except now she portrays it more like Tolerate It, with a side order of Bejeweled. This is an album nobody saw coming, even though she gave so many signs. If you're looking for happy endings, you've got exactly one of those in The Alchemy. It seems that Taylor has fallen for an NFL player. Hey, has anyone heard about that? She has a blast with her love is like football metaphors, singing, "When I touch down, call the amateurs and cut them from the team." She and Travis Kelce find true romance at the Super Bowl. He was trying to be the greatest in the league. Where's the trophy? He just comes running over to me. But if you're stuck on happy endings, why the hell are you listening to a Taylor album? The Alchemy is an outlier on an album where her heart goes 1 for 16. My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys and I Can Fix Him, No Really I Can, are witty reports on falling in love with needy men who don't reciprocate. As the doll sings in My Boy, "Pull my string and I'll tell you that he runs because he loves me." Swift wrote two of the nastiest highlights solo, My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys and Who's Afraid of Little Old Me. Aaron Dresner worked on the softer tracks, So Long London, LOML, while Jack Antonoff provides the big bam boom, as in the synth disco Vince Clarke homage, I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. Post Malone sounds great in the single Fortnite, just as Florence Welch does in Florida, It's a Hell of a Drug, with its dynamic chorus, Fuck Me Up, Florida. When it comes to a one-line summary of how it feels to be single and jaded in your 30s, you can't do much better than, My friends all smell like weed or little babies. So many of these songs are adult Taylor, single again, revisiting the kind of 0-60 romantic crash and burns she's used to cram into a weekend back in her early albums, but from a new perspective. So there's a dialogue between her teen and adult selves. But Daddy, I Love Him is an update of Love Story with a slightly older Romeo and Juliet, except this time her Shakespearean references come from Hamlet. The smallest man who ever lived could be called the angriest song I'll ever write, bombarding an ex with rapid-fire questions. Were you sent by someone who wanted me dead? Did you sleep with a gun underneath our bed? Were you writing a book? Were you a sleeper cell spy? In 50 years' time, will all this be declassified and you'll confess why you did it? The Manuscript is a bonus track, but it's one of the pivotal songs. Taylor likes to do it that way. Ask any fan of New Romantics or Right Where You Left Me. A young woman falls for a charming older man. He said if the sex was half as good as a conversation, soon they'd be pushing strollers, but soon it was over. Looking back at it later, she still isn't clear how she feels about this story. He said since she was so wise beyond her years, everything had been above board. She wasn't sure. But it's her manuscript and her life to write, just as it's her name to disgrace. It's not really a song about a man. It's about a woman starting to see herself as the author instead of just a character in her own life. Stevie Nicks' introductory poem, only in the physical edition, comes from last summer, dated August 13th, with Stevie writing, For T and Me. It's the kind of rock and roll melodrama Stevie knows well. She looked back from her future and shed a few tears. He looked into his past and actually felt fear. Stevie is a guiding angel all over these songs, so it's a powerful moment when Taylor slips her into the killer finale, Clara Bow. It's an ode to a tragic 1920s movie star, which is definitely Stevie's kind of thing. One of her greatest recent songs is her ode to Mabel Normand. Clara Bow was a flapper icon, starring in movies like Man Trap and It. The nickname It Girl was invented for her, but then she got abruptly forgotten and left behind by history. It's a story Swift has told often before, from The Lucky One to Nothing New, but she's singing in the voice of the starstruck small-town girl flattered to be molded into a Hollywood ingenue. The suits tell her, you look like Stevie Nicks in 75, the hair and lips, crowd goes wild at her fingertips, half moonshine, a full eclipse. Fans of Taylor's long-running obsession with solar eclipses will note the brilliant timing of this line. But at the end of the song, the washed-up ingenue listens as her replacement gets a new set of compliments. You look like Taylor Swift in this light. We're loving it. You've got edge. She never did. It's the nightmare of nothing new come true. People forget about yesterday's ingenue. But this isn't merely a song about showbiz. It's about any adult who wonders why, after all these years, she still feels pain or terror when someone else lights up the room. The Tortured Poets Department has a reputation edge to it, and like Reputation, it sounds designed to confuse many people who try to decode it before listening. In her summary poem, Taylor calls it a debrief, a detailed rewinding, for the purpose of warning, for the sake of reminding. But anyone can hear that deep in the music. All over these songs, Taylor lives up to her credo that all's fair in love and poetry, but as she shows in the Tortured Poets Department, both can get brutal. And again, that's Come for the Torture, Stay for the Poetry. This might be Taylor Swift's most personal album yet, by Rob Sheffield. Our next article from RollingStone.com is by David Fear. This was posted on April 7th, 2024, and it's called There Were Punches I Didn't Want to Pull: Why Dev Patel Needed to Make Monkey Man. All Dev Patel knew was the man was wearing a rubber monkey mask. Past that, everything else was a mystery. The 33-year-old actor had this image stuck in his head. There's a young man, sweaty and battered, standing in a crude wrestling ring located in what Patel excitedly describes as the armpit of India. There's a crowd there, already whipped into a frenzy. They're screaming, howling insults, throwing garbage at the fighter. He seems unfazed by all of it. Then the figure pulls out that simian mask, slips it on, and puts up his dukes. Patel had no idea how this character in his mind's eye arrived at this moment of reckoning. He just felt like the moment was so visceral, so intense, so palpably real to him that he could not shake it. Patel was a lifelong lover of action movies, ever since he'd snuck down the stairs as a child and caught scenes from a Bruce Lee movie playing on his parents' TV set. Over the years, his cinematic diet had included any number of movies featuring kinetic standoffs and limb-blurring fight sequences from South Korea, Hong Kong, Indonesia, India, and occasionally Hollywood, USA. He sensed that his imaginary brawler was a hero who would take a beating for a living, but he was righteous. All that masochism was tied up in trauma. It was just a question of, what was this person's trauma? But I could sense it. It felt like a sort of starting point for something. As for the mask, Patel had not yet connected it to the stories that his grandfather would tell him when the family went to visit the elderly man in Kenya. But later, he'd recall the stories of Hanuman, a mythical character in the Indian epic Ramayana, known as the Monkey Man, who led an army of warriors in battle against demons. He represented strength, honor, and courage. Go to any gym in India, Patel says, and you'll see a Hanuman's picture on the wall. The mask may or may not have been a subliminal nod to this figure who loomed larger than life in his imagination as a child, but eventually, the line between the two, a mythic superhero and a guy in a mask, would make itself explicit. But at first, I just wrote those two words down, Monkey Man, Patel recalls. I had no idea where it would lead or what it meant, but now, he laughs as his face registers a sort of wide-eyed shock and he gestures at a poster of his silhouette framed ominously in a doorway against a red background. It led to this. Both Dev Patel's directorial debut and his bid for entry into the action hero pantheon, Monkey Man follows his character, an underground fighter known only as The Kid, as he infiltrates the inner workings of a club catering to the big city's elite. He's got revenge on his mind, and a target, a corrupt police chief, Sikandir Kher, in his sights. As the reasons for his vengeance become clearer, the scope of his rage expands. Soon, he's taking on not just one villain, but an entire caste system rotting from the top down and rife with religious exploitation. Patel originally envisioned this idea of a man in the mask, fighting to avenge a childhood trauma, as a potential role for himself. Eventually, he'd become the film's co-writer and director as well as its star, going through the looking glass from longtime action movie fan to first-time coordinator of Fists and Feet of Fury, Chaos. I've loved this genre for so long, and I felt like it never quite gets its due, Patel says, leaning forward and practically vibrating off the hotel couch he's sitting on. There have been a lot of incredible action movies over the past decade, don't get me wrong, but as a fan, it's like watching a girl you've always admired or been madly in love with at school who's always dating the wrong guys or are constantly with people who treat her badly. I'm like, you're way too good for them. You deserve better. You are worth so much more. After that initial image presented itself to Patel around 2014 or so, and the Oscar-nominated actor wrote those two words down, he filed the idea away. But he kept bringing it up to folks around him, describing random scenes or detailing how a fight in, say, a restaurant's kitchen might play out via certain camera angles. He'd be describing takes of this movie in his head in between takes of the movies he was acting in, Jamon Thomas, Dev's longtime producing partner, says. Certain elements would come and go. For a long time, Patel says, the bad guy was an industrialist, but he had the basic concept and what was more or less a three-act structure down pat. Eventually, he hired a friend of his, Paul Angunawela, to write a screenplay. After several months, Angunawela pulled him aside. He told me he'd been struggling with it, and nothing was really moving, Patel recalls. He was like, this movie is already in your head. You're the one that can get it out of there and onto the page. I stopped taking jobs, settled in LA, and then we'd go to this cafe in Koreatown, eating two ramens a day and Korean barbecue at night, then just wrote like fiends for a year. Both Angunawela and Hotel Mumbai's John Colley are credited as screenwriters. Patel has a story-by credit. Once the script began to shape up, Patel reached out to Neil Blomkamp, whom he'd worked with on 2015's Chappie. The South African filmmaker was intrigued by the movie that Patel was describing in great detail, until finally he asked him point-blank, "Why are you coming to me with this?" He was basically like, "Dev, you know every frame of this film is in your head. You're already talking about costumes. You need to direct this, man. One of the reasons that the Hanuman mythology resonates with me, if I'm being honest, is that he was punished by the gods and lost faith in himself, Patel continues. He lost sight of his powers. He had to be reminded of who he was. And as someone who struggles with anxiety and has a lot of issues around competence and self-confidence, I love that. I love underdog heroes. So after Neil said that to me, it went from, I could never do this, to, maybe he's right, I have to do this. It really became this opportunity for me to put the film in my head on the screen. And did he have any idea what he was getting himself into? Patel shakes his head and sighs, I wouldn't be talking to you right here, right now, if I had. The story behind the production of Monkey Man has already become its own epic tale of obstacles overcome, suffering injuries and interruptions, being knocked down and getting back up again against all odds. But before that Job-like tale could begin in earnest, Patel had to get his feet wet. When he went to Thomas and told him that he wanted to direct and star in this action movie, his partner told him he'd have his back. But in order to let potential financiers know that Dev could handle double duty, Thomas wanted him to do something a little more modest first. It wasn't going to be a proof of concept type of thing, he says. I just wanted him to have some experience behind the camera. The result was Home Shopper, a 16-minute short about a woman with an addiction to shopping channels that premiered at Sundance in 2018. It was enough to get the ball rolling. There was also the issue of Patel's ability to pull off camera-ready fight sequences, given that his previous roles had rarely called on him to go full John Wick against his co-stars. He'd studied martial arts as a kid, a little bit of taekwondo, a little bit of karate, and an academy in London's Rainer Lane neighborhood offered him an outlet. That hyperactive boy in class became a different kid when he stepped into the dojo, Patel recalls. I think I was the youngest person to earn a black belt in class and ended up training the child students we called the Little Dragons. Still, it had been years since he'd competed and trained. I was a bit rusty, to put it mildly, he admits. So Patel began devoting himself to training, spending months getting to the point where he felt that muscle memory buried deep down in my body could start to take over. By early 2020, he and a friend relocated to India, doing what he called mini-location scouting. He said he could feel some friction with the financiers, who were eager for him to start shooting. A crew was assembled, everything seemed to be heading in the right direction, and then Patel began hearing about some virus in China that was causing headlines. We just started filming in one of the biggest slums in India when the pandemic hit, Patel says. I got the last seat on the last flight out of Mumbai. While the world was grinding to a halt, Thomas had reached out to someone he'd met in Singapore at a film festival. This person owned a hotel in Batam, a city located on the Ryu Islands in Indonesia. They came up with a way to keep the film crew in a bubble and shoot the project there. When Patel and Thomas first got to Batam, the first-time director remembers thinking, "Fuck, the lighting here is completely different. We're going to have to change a few things." But it was a total lifeline. They reassembled as many crew members as they could and recast parts with the local tailor and the local accountant, since there were issues regarding the borders and bringing actors in. Soon, they were ready to call action, and that's when the real trouble began. I mean, if you can imagine a problem that would plague a film shoot, it happened to us, Patel says. He's not exaggerating. Right before they were set to restart production, a stuntman accidentally stomped on Patel's foot and broke several toes. Which makes doing a scene in which you have to spin on one foot and kick someone in the chest a little difficult, Patel notes with a laugh. While filming his first fight scene, Patel immediately broke his hand. Thomas recalls taking him to a doctor, watching Patel getting a screw put into his knuckles, and listen as the director Star was told that any further strain could permanently damage it. Patel then went back to the set and immediately started trading blows for the camera once again, liability be damned. We had to thoroughly walk the stuntmen through every single punch, the producer says. The hits kept coming. The film's gaffer suffered a fatal heart attack, which hit everyone like a cannonball to the chest, and his son took over. Patel contracted a nasty eye infection while shooting a fight sequence in a dirty bathroom. Walking into a bar set designed to house one of the movie's climactic showdowns, Patel noticed there was no glass tabletops. "Where's the glass?" he asked the set decorator. He goes, "Sorry, no money," Patel says. "Everyone's ready to shoot. I have to go to the accountant and there's like $75 left. That's it. so we're running credit cards and shooting above the shoulder one day before we can go and get the glass cut and do the rest of it. Necessity became the mother of invention. If equipment stopped working, he adds, you couldn't fly new gear onto the island, so Patel had to resort to using his mobile phone and GoPro cameras at times. A staircase on set was too narrow to shoot a melee, so they used the staircase as their production office. Patel remembers a crane breaking on a day that a studio executive was visiting, and him asking Thomas to distract the visitor while he set up a camera on a rope and swung it over a crowd, which wasn't something that I think that person would have signed off on, he adds. And yet, despite the one-step-forward, three-steps-back waltz that Patel, his crew, and his actors were forced to do, he loved what they were getting on film. The movie that he saw in his head was becoming a reality. Once he wrapped on Bottom and did a few guerrilla shoots of his own once he was able to go back to India, Patel estimates that 98% was shot in Indonesia, while sequences like an elaborate pickpocket scam was done run-and-gun style in Mumbai, he began working with editors on assembling a rough cut. They had made it through the bad times, Patel thought. It was merely the end of one set of headaches, however, and the beginning of a fresh batch of new ones. When Netflix sent out its slate of upcoming releases in the early part of 2022, Monkey Man was among the titles listed as highlights for the year. The streamer had expressed interest in Patel's directorial debut, and while Thomas mentions the fact that the theatrical run was unlikely if they went that route, both he and Patel eagerly signed on to work with them. The title was eventually bumped to a 2023 release and soon seemed to disappear altogether. Then, this past January, a trailer appeared online with a Universal logo attached to the front and a spring release date. What accounted for that switch? Here's where things start to drift into the territory of hearsay and industry gossip. Rumors began to go around that Patel's film touched upon some sensitive areas regarding India's caste system and the way that the mix of religion and nationalism had become an unfortunate part of the nation's contemporary landscape. The folks who would be releasing Monkey Man were thought to be wary of alienating or outright offending folks, especially in a lucrative market. Changes to the film that would temper its more incendiary jabs may or may not have been requested. Said edits may or may not have been balked at, which may or may not have led to the relationship dissolving. Netflix has not commented publicly on any of this in the lead-up to or the reception after the film's premiere at South by Southwest in March. Mention these rumors to Patel, and you will witness the most extraordinary poker face ever. He doesn't confirm anything, nor does he deny it. He merely goes, takes a moment, then makes a joke about whether a sniper's laser scope has been trained on him or not. There were certain punches I didn't want to pull, Patel finally says. Do you know what I mean? There were certain things in the film that I knew would be divisive. There were certain points I wanted to make about a country I love very, very much. There are parts of a culture that I love and that I wanted to share, and that criticizing other aspects of it might ruffle feathers. Without those elements, it wouldn't be the movie I wanted to make. Lots of other stars could make that movie. I just couldn't. There would be no Monkey Man without that. Suddenly, the film found itself without a home. Patel, by his own admission, just walked away from it. Thomas began making inquiries about other potential interested parties. Both Patel and Thomas mentioned that it had been accepted as a submission for a major fall film festival, the same one, each respectively notes, that helped launch Slumdog Millionaire all those years ago, and Thomas hoped to attract buyers there. Then, out of the blue, Patel got a phone call from his agent. He asked me if I was a fan of Jordan Peele, he says, which is a ridiculous question because who isn't a fan of Jordan Peele's? We happen to share the same representation, and my agent had sort of slipped a copy of Monkey Man to Jordan. He's seen it 3 times, and he's going to call you. We ended up having this long conversation where Jordan told me, look, I totally get what you're doing here. I love the film. It's exactly the kind of thing we're trying to do at Peele's production company, Monkey Paw, and I hope you don't mind, but I showed it to the folks at Universal, and they want to put it out. It was around that point that I just fell out of my chair. Once the deal was finalized, Thomas and Patel pulled the film from the festival, and Universal gave them extra funding to polish a few post-production elements. When Peele introduced Patel at South by Southwest to introduce the first public Monkey Man screening, the latter could barely contain his emotions. After he returned to the stage while the end credits ran, he openly wept. It was the image of that man in the mask that he first had but as part of a journey that had happened on and off screen. For Patel, it was a dream come true. I was an executive producer on this documentary called To Kill a Tiger, which was about a 13-year-old girl who was assaulted, he says, referring to Nisha Pahuja's Oscar-nominated feature. It's one of the most compelling things I'd ever seen, and the fact that the audience for something like this is, unfortunately, so limited, it just broke my heart. So I wanted to talk about issues like violence against women, he adds, and police brutality, the caste system, religion, and specifically the kind of duality of religion that we see not just in India, but in so many places around the world right now. Religion at its best is actually a uniting and unifying force, you know? It should make people fight for each other instead of against each other. But all of that stuff is connected, and so much of my rage over these divisions made it into this film. I had so much anger in me when we were writing this. Patel takes a long breath and exhales before he goes on. What I realized early on, however, was that I didn't want to make a history lesson or a polemic. I wanted to make a gateway drug. I wanted a sort of Trojan horse, you know, in terms of action films. I wanted to give it a relevance and kind of cultural and social weight, as well as that adrenaline rush. Again, it goes back to loving action movies and feeling like so many people underestimate audiences when they make them. But also, he adds, I've realized that there is an entire generation out there like me that grew up on Korean action movies and Shah Rukh Khan blockbusters and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Carrey. I wanted to give those of us who want our own hero our own story. I wanted to make an action film that both said something and that little dev would have watched over and over again. And I think I actually managed to pull it off. And again, that's There Were Punches I Didn't Want to Pull, Why Dev Patel Needed to Make Monkey Man by David Fear. Finally today, our last article from RollingStone.com is by Nikki McCann Ramirez. This was posted on April 19th, 2024, and it's called They've Taken Away My Right to Speak, Trump Says While Ranting to Reporters. Donald Trump claimed on Friday that he has been stripped of his constitutional right to speak to the press while ranting to a giant gaggle of reporters. The former president took time before entering court in his criminal hush money trial to once again complain about a gag order barring him from attacking witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors involved in the case. The gag order has to come off. People are allowed to speak about me, and I have a gag order, Trump said. They are taking away my constitutional rights to speak, and that includes speaking to you. I have a lot to say to you, and I'm not allowed to say it. I'm the only one. Everyone else can say whatever they want about me. They can say anything they want. They can continue to make up lies. But I'm not allowed to speak. I want to speak to the press and everybody else about it. So why am I gagged? Trump has, in fact, been speaking, loudly, to everyone. The former president rails about the case to the press multiple times a day when entering and exiting the courtroom, and has also been posting his thoughts on the trial with his characteristic barrage of commentary on Truth Social. What Trump is not allowed to do is use his public statements to attempt to influence, intimidate, or attack those involved in the trial, a standard ask of criminal defendants. Even those minimal restrictions are proving difficult for the former president to manage. Trump's actions during the ongoing jury selection process have even led to a reprimand from Judge Juan Merchan. On Tuesday, Merchan sharply admonished Trump and his team after the former president was heard muttering commentary during the questioning of potential jurors. I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom. I want to make that crystal clear, Merchan said. Yet for all of Trump's complaining and commentary about the trial and jury selection, the former president can't seem to actually stay engaged in the proceedings. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times reported on Monday that he was dozing off during the proceedings and then noted that he did so again on Friday. Trump also reportedly fell asleep on Tuesday and Thursday. And that's all the time we have for today's Rolling Stone. I'm Brian Kim for the Virginia Voice. You can hear this program Saturdays at 2:30 p.m. and again on Wednesdays at 9:30 p.m. You can also listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org. Thanks for listening.